this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views and the views of our guest. And, of course, the guest this first hour this evening is Pastor David Whitney of the Institute of the Constitution. We're going to be talking about the most amazing document ever created by humankind. And certainly I'm not saying that simply because I'm an American and proud of it, but people throughout the world reading our Constitution have always tried to emulate it as best they could. But, of course, we are unique because we are the only country in the world where, rather than freedom coming from government or being given to the people by the ruling class, in America we acknowledge that freedom came from God, and we didn't want a ruling class, and so we wanted to limit the power of the central authority so men could be free. But unfortunately, there have always been those who wanted to rule. You can go back and read the things that were written just a few years after America was established, and even at that time they recognized there were those who wanted to use the power of the federal government to enslave the people. And with that old adage, you know, whenever you rob from Peter to pay Paul, you can always count on Paul's vote. And so that's why they have always wanted to have a federal government that could provide for the people, so that they would be able, of course, to enslave the people, and that's what it's really all about. Well, we've forgotten about our Constitution. We've forgotten that the power of the central authority was to be limited through all time by the change of the Constitution, because only by limiting the power of government could men be free. Liberty and limited government were synonymous. Tyranny and total government were synonymous. And that's why the work of the Institute of the Constitution is so very important, because they're trying to get the American people to understand why America is different and why we must either restore our Constitution or, of course, freedom as we know it will soon become simply a remembrance of things past. Good evening, David. Thank you so very much for being with us again.
Well, it's always a blessing to be on your show, Dr. Stan. I appreciate the work that you're doing and your audience and their desire to see our constitutional republic restored. I'm glad you mentioned the word chains. It reminds me of Thomas Jefferson's famous quote, "In questions of power, then, let no more be said of confidence in man, but bind him down with the chains of the Constitution." And that's a good picture for our mind mentally, that our Constitution is supposed to be a set of chains holding our central federal government to a very limited role in our society. A very limited role was what our founders designed it to be, and that is not at all what we have today. The chains have been taken off the powers in Washington, D.C., and the chains have been put on we the people. And so instead of government being our servant, which is what it's designed to be, it's to serve us, as Romans 13 says, it's a minister of God, to minister God's law for our good and for our blessing, to punish evildoers and to reward the righteous. That's what the Bible describes in Romans 13, the sole purpose of civil government. It's our servant. It's never to be our master. But in our day, having lost those founding principles, we now have a government that is our master and seeking to enslave every one of us.
And that's exactly right. And, of course, that's why the Institute of the Constitution was founded. It was founded so people could begin to understand the miracle that occurred back in 1787, when the founding fathers of this country created a nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. But that's long since been forgotten, hasn't it?
Yes, it has.
Well, go right ahead, David.
Well, we've been walking through the subsequent amendments to the Constitution. We, of course, looked at the Bill of Rights, which is were ratified all together as one group, the first 10 amendments, and they clearly restricted the powers of our federal government even further than the seven articles of our Constitution. Then we've been walking through the subsequent amendments, and we've seen how most of them, with a few few significant exceptions. There are exceptions, but most of them expand the federal the powers of the federal government in a way that is completely contrary to what our founders designed and desired for our federal government to be. Well, people need to remember that there is a clear sense of what human fallen nature is on the part of our founding fathers, that all men are sinners, that even the best of men, even a regenerated Christian who is godly, still has a sin nature and has the potential to act sinfully. Therefore, no man is ever to be trusted unchecked with power given to them. And so the checks and balances built into our system, people usually think of the three branches of government, that the legislative, executive, and judiciary all serve as checks and balances against one another, the separation of powers doctrine, that these all have an equal power in terms of their role in our civil government. But most people have never heard that our founders also designed four levels of government, that those levels of government each would as well be a check against the other levels of government. That is the federal government, the state government, and then on down to the county and then the local, whether it be a town or a township. And actually, they drew this out of Scripture. If you read Exodus chapter 18, you see those four levels of government clearly spelled out, rulers of thousands, and rulers of hundreds, and rulers of fifties, and rulers of tens, and that's in reference to families, so 10 families would be the lowest level of representation, and on up it would go. And so those four levels of government were drawn right out of Scripture, a pattern that God had established in the Old Testament for His people in the Hebrew Republic. Again, most people have no idea. They've heard of the Hebrew monarchy with the famous kings like King Saul and King David and King Solomon and so forth. But before the Hebrew monarchy was instituted, God gave His people the perfect form of government, a Hebrew republic. And in fact, Scripture says that God told them, this is the best form of government. You do not want a monarchy. The warning Samuel gave to the people of Israel that the king is going to do heavy taxation, the king is going to be oppressive, the king is going to make your lives miserable and take your sons for his wars and so on. Long list of evil things that the Hebrew monarchy was going to bring upon the people, but they would not listen to God's warnings through Samuel, and so they demanded a king. But before the king, it was a republic. That is a representative form of government.
Hold that thought right there, David. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Pastor David Whitney was simply talking about the way that the Jewish state was originally set up before they had kings. And we'd suggest you read 1 Samuel, the 8th chapter, with the story of what happened when the children of Israel decided that they really didn't want to be simply living under God's law. They wanted a king, and of course Samuel said, you don't want a king, and they said, oh, we do, we want a king. And so Samuel went to God, and God said, Samuel, it's not that they've turned against you, it's they've turned against me. Give them a king, but tell them what will happen. First of all, there'll be taxes. I mean, the king will take 10% of whatever you have. And of course, the king was much more benevolent than the IRS today. And then, of course, the king, then God said, and the king will take their sons and daughters and have them working in his fields and running beside his chariots in his wars. But give them a king. Let them understand. And so David's point was that before the children of Israel actually insisted on a king, and their first king was Saul, of course, they had a free society. It was really a republican form of government where they were ruled not by officials, they were ruled by God's law. And that was what it was all about. And there was no central authority to oppress them. There were judges appointed by the leaders, but there was no executive, there was no legislative. There were simply free people. Go ahead, David.
And so in that perfect design, as God's Word describes it, there are four levels of government that are established. And our founders, being in the most part godly Christians, there were some who we would say were not Orthodox Christians. They were in the very, very, very smallest minority. And even those who are not Orthodox Christians were Christian in their understanding of law and government. The Bible shaped their thinking. People like Thomas Jefferson and Ben Franklin probably were not Orthodox Christians, but nonetheless, they had a biblical view of law and government far better than most so-called Christians today have. But they based the structure of our form of government on that Hebrew Republic. And therefore, they created four levels of government. And these four levels of government were a very important check upon the powers that each level had. And some powers were to be at the local, the very closest to the people, other powers up higher. But the design of the federal government, as you look at our Constitution and you look at the commentaries on our Constitution that were given by those closest to the founders, you look at the debates, Madison's notes, all these things indicate they were very wary of giving unlimited power to the federal government. They knew that the federal government could very quickly become a tyrannical master if it was not very carefully guarded against. And so they structured the seven articles of the Constitution to give only delegated, enumerated powers to the federal government. And, of course, the first ten amendments were the Bill of Rights, and those ten amendments all had to do with restricting the power of the federal government even further. They were very careful to do this, but they knew that if they did not have a balance of power between another governmental authority against the federal government. In other words, if they just let the federal government be the interpreter of the Constitution, the federal government determine the limits of its power, look out. They knew that it would become tyrannical very quickly. Therefore, in their structure of those four levels of government, the state governments, originally the first 13 states, the state governments were to have wide-ranging powers that dealt with every issue of life, liberty, property. Most of what an individual would encounter in any legal sphere would happen with state powers, not with the federal government. The federal government would only deal with those things that it alone could do best. For example, declare war. If one state declared war and the other 12 states said, "Ha, you're on your own," that wouldn't be a very good thing. They needed to all participate together if war was declared. So only the things that had to be done at the federal level were to be done at the federal level, such as forming a treaty between our country and another country. So they wanted most of the functions of civil government to be happening at the state level or below, the county level or the local level, and only the very few items that could not be done at the other three levels to be done at the federal level. And they knew that if you create competition, you have a good thing going. Anywhere you have a monopoly, you're going to have a poor service. You're going to have a high price for that service. You're not going to get what's best for the consumer, in this case, the citizen. So the citizen is going to be best served by his government if there is not a monopoly of government. So if the federal government sucks up all power and authority to itself, it becomes a monopoly. If the state governments have wide-ranging powers, as our founders designed, then no monopoly can be created because the states will prevent the federal government from adding to its powers, and the states, of course, in competition with one another, are going to try to create the best society they can to attract new citizens, to attract business to their state. So they put this balancing of powers in a very wise way, knowing human nature, knowing, again, the sinful, fallen nature of mankind. You cannot trust him with power. By balancing and counterbalancing those powers against one another, they knew they would prevent a tyrannical government from forming.
No, I think, it's so interesting that Thomas Jefferson foresaw the corruption of our courts. I don't know whether he realized it would be the fact that the Masons would take control of our courts between 1941 and 1971 and would dominate the Supreme Court in majorities of 5-4 to 8-1. But this is what he wrote. It has long been my opinion, and I have never shrunk from it, that the germ of dissolution of our federal government is in the constitution of our federal judiciary. For an irresponsible body, for impeachment is scarcely a scarecrow, working like gravity by night and by day, gaining a little today and a little tomorrow, and advancing its noiseless step like a thief over the field of jurisdiction, until it all shall be usurped from the states, and the government of all shall be consolidated into one, and to this I am opposed, because when all government, domestic and foreign, in little as in great things, shall be drawn to Washington as the center of all power, it will render powerless the checks of one government on another, and will become as venal and oppressive as the government from which we have recently separated. And that's, of course, exactly what has happened. It was during the Vietnam War when they sent our boys over to seas to fight and bleed and suffer and die in the no-win war in Vietnam, that the Supreme Court then began to centralize all power in Washington, D.C., undermine the very fabric of a system of checks and balances, and specifically between the states and the central government, and brought us to the tragic situation where we are today, where everything is under federal control. And, of course, we are moving rapidly towards a dictatorship in America. Halliburton is being given $345 million every year, or at least one of the subsidiaries is, to stand by to build concentration camps. And if you doubt that, we'll be glad to send you the article if you ask for it, or you can go up on the Internet and Google it in, Halliburton, $385 million, concentration camps. Everything is in place for a dictatorship. It never could have happened if we had maintained our system of checks and balances, and if the Supreme Court had not betrayed their responsibility and centralized all power in Washington, D.C.
Yes. The last time we talked about the 16th and the 17th Amendment, both of which were a strike against the state's power and a consolidation of power in Washington, D.C., 16th changing, ultimately the misinterpretation, I would say, of the 16th, changing how taxes were collected, no longer from the state, therefore the state having to raise the funds, and instead now the federal government went directly to the citizen in violation of Article 1, Section 9, no capitation tax permitted. And then the 17th Amendment, seeing that senators were no longer appointed by the state legislatures, rather they were voted on, which means the one who had the most money won the election, basically. And the states no longer had a direct link of power to Washington, D.C. to have their agenda, the agenda of the state legislature, fulfilled in Washington, D.C. They no longer, after the 17th Amendment, had that very powerful check upon the actions of the Congress and therefore the rest of the government in Washington, D.C. And we see the result in an explosion in the growth of federal government from 1915, the ratification of the 17th Amendment, which was probably not rightly ratified at all, but nonetheless, from that point forward, it was interpreted as it was ratified, and the federal government exploded in its power, grasp, and size because there was no longer the state check upon the federal government's power. Well, 4 years later, the 18th Amendment was ratified. This is the amendment that basically prohibited alcohol. And this amendment gave the federal government authority over a matter that had been up to this point in time local law enforcement, either at the state level or the county level or the town level. In other words, the town might decide whether alcohol could be sold. I know of a town here in Maryland that is still a dry town that does not permit the sale of alcohol. Sure, you can go a few miles down the road and purchase alcohol, but it was a local decision. It can also be a countywide decision. I remember whole counties in places like Texas that were dry. You had to go outside the boundaries of that county to be able to purchase any alcohol. Or even today, the state of Pennsylvania has what's called state stores. That's where all liquor is sold in Pennsylvania, comes from a state store. The state has control over the sale and distribution of alcohol within its boundaries.
Well, he said he would be far better off if we could get back to this concept where the power was decentralized. But, of course, there have always been those who wanted all power in Washington, D.C., because it's much easier to bribe, the 100 United States senators or even 51 United States senators than have to bribe the legislatures in all 50 states. So that's why the people of great wealth and great power wanted to centralize all power in Washington, D.C., many times, using the socialists and communists to accomplish that goal, because, of course, that way the elite would be able to control everyone and everything. Go right ahead, David.
Well, the move for the enactment of the 18th Amendment started way, way back, in a sense, with the temperance movement.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mined supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Most Americans are iodine deficient today because they stopped adding iodine to our milk and to our flour, and only about half of the salt that's consumed in the United States today contains iodine. So Radio Liberty has produced a four tape or a four CD set that discusses the health benefits of iodine. We also offer Iodorol. It contains 12.5 milligrams of iodine per tablet. And we also offer potassium iodide tablets that'll protect your thyroid gland in case there's a nuclear attack. So if you'd like to order these products or obtain additional information, why don't you call 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Or go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. Once again, our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927.
You got headaches? Most headaches are caused by a structural weakness of blood vessels in the head, and the blood vessels are tending to balloon, causing a headache. The structural weakness is due to a deficiency. Correct the deficiency and the body will heal itself. I blended what I believed to be the missing nutrients in the right proportions, and the headaches went away. When they were gone, they stayed gone. I named it Headache Stay Gone. See HeadacheStayGone.com or call 800-327-0727 for more information or to place an order. I'll send you a bottle of Headache Stay Gone. Headache Stay Gone will cure your headaches and prevent them from coming back before you pay the bill. Headache Stay Gone has already cured the worst migraines I have ever heard of. Call 800-327-0727. All orders are shipped the same day. Call 800-327-0727. That's 800-327-0727.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763 or online at healthyfoundations.net.
The closest thing to eternal life you'll ever find in this world is the government bureaucracy. And, of course, the last thing that our founders wanted was a federal police force of any sort. And so they actually gave the maximum power to any government official to the local sheriff. And every county was to have a sheriff, and he was the most powerful person in the county. He could arrest anybody in the county he wanted to. He was the law, and we wanted to keep law close to the local level. We did not want, of course, a federal police force. It is what we have today now. The federal police are organizing the local police, so our local police are simply an extension of the federal police, the Gestapo, call it what you will, but believe me, they do abuse their power and their privilege, as we saw at Waco, as we saw at Ruby Ridge. And no government official is ever held responsible, no matter how many people are killed. Go right ahead, David.
And the design was wise because they knew at the federal level, if you have a police force, they really didn't want any police action, any police force from the federal level. Keep it at the local level. Because if you have it from the federal level, then who is going to reward or punish that FBI agent? We had an incident here in our county where a young man was driving down the street with his girlfriend and there had been a bank robbery somewhere in the area, and the FBI pulled the man over, and as he was rolling down his window, an FBI agent shot this man in the face. He nearly killed him. He didn't have a gun. He wasn't armed. He wasn't doing anything wrong. He was simply driving down the street and pulled over. The guy barely survived. He was in the hospital for some time. And you know what? That FBI agent was never held accountable for his egregious actions and egregious violations of the rights of a citizen to life and liberty. It's just crazy. Because our founders knew that any time you have a police force that's not accountable to the people, directly accountable to the people, that police force will become tyrannical and will abuse the rights to life, liberty, and property of the people. They knew that a sheriff, standing for election every 4 years, he's going to be accountable to the people, and those police officers deputized by him under his control, they also will be turned over every 4 years. And so if they care about their job, they know their job is up for grabs every 4 years. If they don't serve the people, to serve and protect, then they're going to lose their job. And so the sheriff, in fact, still the sheriff is the most powerful law enforcement officer in the United States. The trick is, the sheriffs often don't know that. Secondly, they are bribed. Well, it doesn't look like a bribe. The federal government gives them computers. The federal government in our part of the country is just pouring millions upon millions of dollars into cameras at every corner and intersection in the county. And so the county gets this massive surveillance system given to them by the federal government with federal taxpayers' dollars, that is, you and I paying for it. But then they have an in with the sheriff and say, hey, you know, you need to give our FBI free rein in your county. You know, you need to let BATF do whatever they want. We've given you all this stuff, haven't we?
And of course, what they really want to do is watch everybody, watch everything, monitor everybody, listen to their telephone calls, read their emails, read their faxes. And if you don't believe they did this long before 911, having nothing to do with terrorism, go up on the Internet and just type in Echelon, E-S-C-H-A-L-O-N, Echelon, and you'll find out this is a long-range program. It has nothing to do with terrorism. It has everything to do with watching you, collecting dossiers on you, and monitoring your financial transactions, learning everything they can about your health and health issues. And when you go to the doctor today, and of course they say, well, we want you to sign this form up, you know, because we want to protect the privacy of records. Have you ever read what it's about? It gives them the ability to turn your private records over to anybody they want to, anybody who wants to get them. Any federal official has full access to your health, all in the name of privacy. They say one thing, it's a lie. They simply deceive the people, and most of them. I wonder how many people have gone to their doctor or dentist and actually read that privacy form they have there now. I mean, it's almost ludicrous that people could be so gullible. Go ahead, David.
Well, that 18th Amendment vastly expanded the power of the federal government in damaging ways to our life, our liberty, and our property. And it has not been retracted. It's been expanding ever since that 18th Amendment was ratified in 1919.
Even though the 18th Amendment was eventually repealed.
Yes.
But, of course, the eternal life of the bureaucracy goes on and will be there as long as our country exists, unless the American people understand and insist that the Constitution be restored and the power of the federal government limited. Well, David, go right ahead.
Well, as you have stated, the 18th Amendment ultimately was repealed in 1933 by the 21st Amendment. Now, there's several important things to note here. First of all, is that an amendment to the Constitution can be repealed, other than, of course, the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments. All the additional amendments, all the additional 17, and I have a selected number in my mind that I would love to see repealed. Zell Miller called for the repeal of the 17th Amendment. I thoroughly agree with him, and 16th and 15th and 14th and 13th, we could go through a whole long list of ones to get rid of. But the point is that they can be repealed. They're not set in stone. It's the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, first seven articles. Those are set in stone in terms of our form of government. We can repeal some of these other violations of the design and structure that our founders laid out for us. And, of course, the arguments were that, well, the 18th Amendment wasn't working so well. Selective enforcement never works well. It appears to me, at least the research I've done on it, is that the selective enforcement was designed to hurt the little guy. That is, somebody with a moonshine still out on their back 40 in the hills of Tennessee, the revenuers went after him and busted down his still, but they did nothing to touch somebody like the Kennedys that made millions upon millions of dollars running rum into the New England states. So the big guys who were able to pay off with political favors or money, whatever it was, the big guys were untouched. And that's why the speakeasy business in the Roaring Twenties went on without any check. So the revenuers were very selective. They went after the small guy, the individual, the citizen, and they let the evildoers, the wicked Kennedys and people like that, get away with it. And it's obvious that in that period of time, you could get alcohol. It was expensive, and they had to do it secretively, but you could certainly get as much alcohol as you wanted if you had the money to pay for it, and certain people became extremely wealthy as a result of selective enforcement. Now, if a law applies, it should apply to everyone, rich, poor, alike. Scripture says again and again that it is an evil thing when a judge or a law enforcement official accepts a bribe, if they turn the blind eye, if they treat people unequally, and certainly it is true that the 18th Amendment was applied unequally to people in various parts of the country. And so the repeal of it is good, because it hadn't worked because of selective enforcement, and the amendment restored the authority to regulate alcoholic beverages back to the states or the local communities, which is where it actually belongs. Again, if the federal government doesn't
hold
need
that thought,
to do
David,
it...
David. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Pastor David Whitney from the Institute of the Constitution. And before we go on, David, I'd like you to get your website out, your telephone number, so those who would be interested in learning more about the Institute, about your training program, about the really this wonderful Constitution we have, which is the very foundation of our freedom, so people will know where they can get the information. What's the website? What's the telephone number?
Thank you, Dr. Stan. Our website, where people can go and purchase in our web store what we call a host kit, which is a way that you can communicate these truths to any group of people, and you need to be assured that you're not actually teaching the material. Put a DVD in, or VHS, we have it in that format as well, of 12 lectures by constitutional law professor John Eismo, and he walks through the Christian History Foundation, the biblical worldview of law and government that underlie the founding documents, our Declaration, a working knowledge of our Declaration, a working knowledge of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and then the subsequent amendments, as well as why we are in the state we're in today, where we have a tyrannical government. What we have shifted away from is biblical absolutes of our founders' era to evolutionary humanism, complete relativism of our day, where words don't mean anything. You know, the former president couldn't tell you what the definition of the word is. I mean, what insanity. How could somebody even live with themselves if they can't define words like that are that simple? So it gives you a way to understand how we got to this place, and a way to equip yourself, really, to function as a citizen. The problem of America is due to citizens not knowing the supreme law of the land, the U.S. Constitution, therefore not being able to hold their elected officials accountable, therefore not being able to wisely choose whom to vote for at the ballot box.
And of course, if you have an elected official who does not understand the Constitution, he does not deserve your vote. I mean, these men will all swear to uphold the Constitution and to defend it against all enemies, both foreign and domestic. And if they can't answer simple questions about the Constitution, why, of course, they're going to vote the wrong way. They're going to vote for, oh, well, it's a good idea. Yeah, I think this is going to benefit me. I think it's going to benefit my community. We'll just make this concession and we'll trade votes back and forth. And that can't be the way our system works.
Yeah.
The people have to adhere to the Constitution. They don't have to already go through and evaluate all of the bills. The question is it constitutional or isn't it? If it isn't constitutional, it should have a no vote. I wonder how many of the congressmen ever even consider that when they're voting, and I would say very, very few. Go right ahead, David.
Well, you can go to our website and go to our web store and purchase a host kit there. Our website is iotconline.com. That's iotconline.com. And if you don't have web access or if you would prefer to purchase it by phone, you can call us at Institute on the Constitution. Our toll-free number is 866-730-9796. That toll-free number for Institute on the Constitution is 866-730-9796. And this week we had a great encouragement. We have a congressional office, Washington, D.C., that's contacted us and wants to use our host kit to train its staff on the Constitution. Oh, praise God. This is so exciting because we've been praying for this kind of opportunity for some time because we understand that oftentimes congressmen, they never wind up reading the bills that come across their way. It's their staffers who are the key gatekeepers to decide what bills get put before the congressman and recommended or what bills get thrown in the trash can and never recommended. And so these congressional staffers are extremely important gatekeepers. So one congressman's office has asked us to get a host kit to them and get materials to them to help them train their staffers as to what the Constitution actually says. So exciting. We've been doing that here on a local level, training people in our state legislature, senators and delegates in Maryland state legislature, on the U.S. Constitution this past legislative session. The coming one, we're actually going to conduct our course on the Maryland state constitution with the state senators and delegates in Maryland's capital, Annapolis. So training these people who are in power as to what the limits of government are is very important. But most of those people in power, they don't care. They want to get away with whatever they can get away with. The only way we can stop them from becoming tyrants is if we, the people, know this supreme law of the land, having a working knowledge of the Declaration, the Constitution, and the Bill of Rights, and we hold our elected officials accountable to it, and we demand that they answer specific questions. And you can go to our website. We have a web page that is specific questions to ask your potential senator or congressman or president to find out if they're competent. Do they know basic things about our Constitution? There's a whole page devoted to that. Is your representative competent? And I know that as I listen to the debates and so forth of the current contenders for the presidency, there's only one that knows anything about the Constitution and demonstrates that knowledge, and that is the Honorable Ron Paul.
And, of course, the thing is that we are not a democracy. It doesn't matter if the president says we are, that all this, almost every senator, almost every congressmen, certainly our educational leaders, the people of the great foundations, the bankers, everybody says we're a democracy. We're not. You can read the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, the constitutions of all 50 states. You can read certainly the Declaration of Independence. You'll never see the use of the word democracy other than to say we don't want a democracy, because democracies always end up with turmoil and contention. And, of course, anybody who's ever studied the history of democracies know they end up in dictatorships. And that is why, of course, our leaders want to convince you we are a democracy. We are not. We are a republic, and you better understand the difference between the two. Do you have anything there at the Institute that really explains the difference between a democracy and a republic?
Yes, actually, part of our host kit and part of the course, the Foundations course, which is the course currently available as a host kit, has a section in there that gives quotes from our founders and talks about the evils that our founders called down upon democracies, that we never want to be any such thing. So it is incorporated into our course. The people that purchase the course, the student notebook has those quotes in it, and it's valuable to share those quotes with as many people as you can, because most people think a democracy is a good thing. Oh, our founder said it's a world of evil. It's one of them, I can't remember off the top of my head who it was, but said it's the most evil and dangerous form of government of all. That's important to get across to people. Well, the important thing that happened in the repeal of the 21st Amendment was the point that this area of legislation, this area of control, this area of enforcement belongs at the state or local level, bringing us back to the point we mentioned earlier. If the federal government doesn't need to do it, then the state or local government should do it. Anything the states can do, the states can do better, would be a slogan our founding fathers would agree with. Don't let the federal government do it if the states can do it, or the county, or the local government can do it. Don't let the federal government do anything that is not absolutely essential for the federal government to do, because the states cannot, or the counties cannot, or the local towns cannot do that. So in the repeal of the 18th Amendment, as you mentioned earlier, the sad thing is that the bureaucracies went on, and of course they expanded their powers greatly beyond the powers they even had during the period of time when the 18th Amendment was in force. Well, following right on the heels of the 18th Amendment, 1 year later, 1920, was the ratification of the 19th Amendment, and this was the Woman's Suffrage Amendment. The right to vote cannot be denied on the basis of sex, and actually some states had already passed a law to this effect, and I should mention here again, here's something that is expanding the power of the federal government. If this is an issue to be decided, it should be decided by the states, not by the federal government. It's not the business of the federal government to determine who can and who cannot vote within an individual state. We see the same thing being foisted upon the states today. What about the who knows how many illegal aliens in our country today, millions upon millions, tens of millions of illegal aliens, and if the amnesty bill, they're pushing another one here recently and it's moving ahead in Senate, if that amnesty bill passes, it's going to force the states to accept the illegals who've broken into that state and violated the law. It's going to force them to accept these people as citizens and give them the right to vote. That's not a decision the federal government should make. It should never have made that. And any time the federal government violated that, and it did, by the way, in the 14th Amendment, which we've talked about previously, whenever the federal government violates that jurisdictional boundary, determining for the state who its citizens are, it is tyrannical. Now, you need to understand, from our founders' perspective, and it's true, the states created the federal government. The federal government didn't create the states. The states created the federal government. And you were only a citizen of the United States, small u, United States, because you were a citizen of a particular state. That state determined its citizenship regulations, who would become a citizen, who would not become a citizen. You're only a citizen of the, quote, United, small u, United States, if you were a citizen of a particular state that was part of the United States. I know here in Maryland there was a case in 1801, I believe it was, where it was clearly spelled out by a judge that the standards for citizenship in Maryland were legitimate and constitutional. And those standards in 1801 was that you had to be a professing Christian. That is, if you were an atheist, if you were a Buddhist, if you were a Hindu, or you could live here. You could enjoy some privileges, but you could not become a voting citizen, because if you were not a Christian, you were going to vote non-Christian principles into law, just like Keith Ellison, the congressman who swore his oath of office on the Koran. What does he believe? He believes the Koran is the supreme law of the universe. That's a very dangerous man to have in the position of congressman. You swear on the Bible because you believe the Bible is the supreme law of the universe. Only Christians should be in power in our land because only Christians will preserve this Christian constitutional republic. And so the federal government should never be the one to determine who becomes a citizen and who doesn't become a citizen. And that's the primary issue here, why I believe the 19th Amendment is not a good thing. Yes, it can be decided on the state levels and not the federal level. In addition to that, and I know that there was a wide cry of people who disagree with me on that, that's fine. I'm taking this from a biblical perspective that the scripture clearly states without any doubt that the husband is head of the wife, the father is head of the family, and just as we have a representative republic, that is, we vote a representative to represent us in Congress, he represents us, but he doesn't necessarily do everything we tell him to do. He makes decisions based on his wisdom and so forth. So the father and the husband is the representative of the family. The family is a separate God-given jurisdiction, actually more important than the civil government, even more important than church government, created all the way back at the very beginning in the Garden of Eden, created by God himself, who made Adam the head of his wife Eve and established this structure, and this structure was specifically attacked by the 18th Amendment. I know of an individual in our community who the husband and wife vote against each other every time they go into the ballot box. So they cancel each other's vote out. And the husband then is not the head of his family. He doesn't represent his family at all. The idea that everybody should be given the power to vote, and these days it's even illegal aliens given the right to vote, and that's ridiculous. Our founders knew that the franchise to elect the officials who were going to represent the people should be restricted to a small circle of people who often were property owners, people who had an interest in the decisions going to be made because they were going to be paying the bill. That is, anybody who's going to be on a welfare roll should not be voting because what are they going to vote for? More money for their welfare check. Never let that happen. So expanding the elective franchise, which a number of these amendments deal with, is always, I believe, a bad idea. It should be restricted to those who, as our founder said, we're Christians, because if you don't hold a biblical view of law and government, what are you going to vote for? Marxism? You're going to vote for Hindu or Muslim principles instead of Christian principles? If you vote for Muslim principles, what's going to happen? Your God-given rights and freedom to life, liberty, and property are going to be gone in no time. Same if you vote in Hindu principles or Marxist principles. Anything other than Christian principles are a danger to your life, liberty, and property, whether you're a Christian or not a Christian. So the 18th Amendment, or 19th Amendment, would be a good one, I think, to check off as a one that gets repealed. The 20th Amendment would be a good one to preserve. That was ratified in 1933. It changed the presidential succession in terms of the time the president and vice president would take office. Up to that point in time, March 4th was the earliest the president would and vice president would take office, and that was because of difficulties in terms of transportation and difficulties in terms of communication. You know, they may not even know by February across the country who's actually been elected president and vice president. And, of course, with improved transportation and improved communication, having the president and vice president take office January 20th is what the 20th Amendment accomplished. And also, this was a good move because it reduced the opportunities for a lame duck president as well as lame duck congressman to exert last-minute influence. Oh, and we saw the evil work done by Clinton in all these last-minute pardons and establishing the monuments out west and another land grab, land steal, and so forth. All these kind of things done at the last minute because he knew he didn't have to be accountable to anybody, basically. And that's a bad thing. It indicates the kind of character of that particular president. So having the president take office January 20th was a good decision, and I think the 20th Amendment would be good to preserve. Now, there's a rather long quiet period here from 1933 all the way up to 1951 before the next amendment was ratified, and that is the 22nd Amendment. We already talked about the 21st Amendment repealing the 18th, but the 22nd Amendment limits the term for the president to two terms alone. That is very interesting, and I agree with this. But actually, this was only necessary because of one particular evil and egregious President Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Up to his administration, never had any president gone beyond two-term limits. You see, in the Constitutional Convention, a debate had taken place, and the idea had been put forward to limit the president to two terms. And everybody was in agreement with it. Discussion went well, and when they took a vote on it, everyone noticed that George Washington voted against it. He hadn't said anything about it, but he voted against it. And everyone took note of that and then began to backpedal, and ultimately they removed that from the discussion, put it off the table altogether, because everybody expected and knew that George Washington would be the first president. And yet when George Washington had completed his second term, he said, basically, that's enough for anyone. No one should go beyond two terms. And he set a precedent that all presidents followed up until Franklin Delano Roosevelt.
And, of course, he was elected four times, and fortunately, he died shortly after the beginning of his fourth term. And so this amendment of the Constitution was to limit the president's term in office to two terms. We'll be right back here in a moment or two. Our guest has been David Whitney. The telephone number, 866-730-9796. Well, David, you got 3 minutes to wrap up the program.
And one of the things that I remember about FDR, because my grandmother lived through his tyrannical regime, was that he was the one, the president who stole the gold, forcing Americans to turn in gold coins in exchange for worthless pieces of paper. And he was a president whose actions were actually communistic. You look at the New Deal and what it was involved in and what it was attempting to do here in America. The whole thing was a pack of communist garbage being foisted upon us in these United States. And Americans woke up to it late, unfortunately, too late. A lot of damage had been done by the time they did wake up to it. But nonetheless, they also recognized, we don't want this to happen again. Let's not allow any other president to violate that tradition that from George Washington on down had been followed. Well, the 23rd Amendment was 10 years later in 1961, and this 23rd Amendment did something that I believe is a big mistake. It gave to the District of Columbia electors, that is, for the Electoral College that actually votes on the president, and the D.C. now has electors equal to the number of electors from the least populous state, which would be three electors, two for senators and one for a House of Representatives. And the point that our founders had is they did not want the seat of the federal government, Washington, D.C., to ever be politicized. It was to be protected and insulated from the kind of political things, and therefore, the only people who, nobody really was designed to live there, because Congress was part-time, so Congress would be there during the session for however many months, and then they'd be back in their home district for the rest of the year. So Congress was not a full-time job, it was part-time. Furthermore, that, you know, the president and his family and few other people would be the only people who lived there full-time. You know, other people would come into Washington for certain things, and if you chose to reside within the District of Columbia, that was your choice. And by choosing that, you chose not to participate in presidential elections. You could choose to move out of the district and live where you could actually vote on the presidential election. So this principle of preventing political machinations from happening there in Washington, D.C. was the reason our founders prohibited the District of Columbia from having electors or participating in any of the national electors. They don't have senators or anything else, which is why you look at the license plate. I was just down in D.C. a week or so ago. License plates in D.C. all say taxation without representation. That is, they want to have senators. They want to have congressmen, which would be a further destruction of what our founders knew was a safety net that needed to be placed around the federal government and what happened there in Washington, D.C.
And so they could, of course, get them to give them more money. That's
yes.
What it's about. Thanks very much, David. Bye-bye. God bless.
God bless you.
Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I hope you've enjoyed our conversation with David Whitney. And of course, we have David on every month to talk about the Constitution. The Institute does support Radio Liberty, and we support their efforts because we think this is such an important message. Now, we do have a little pamphlet we put together called This is a Republic. This is a Republic. If you'd like to get it, it's available by calling 1-800 844-859-2957. We Are a Republic is the correct name. We are a republic, and we think it's so important that you know the difference between a democracy and a republic, because democracies, at least according to James Madison, have e'er been spectacles of turbulence and contention, have e'er been incompatible with personal security and private property, and have usually been as short in their lives as they are violent in their deaths. And you know, this hour we're having more crime and more murders and more society instability and more disillusionment today, and it is simply because they've converted us from a republic to a democracy. Get the Federalist Papers. We actually carry them through Radio Liberty. Read the tenth of the Federalist Papers and see what James Madison said. Why we never wanted to have a democracy. And of course, then when you understand that, you'll understand why we are fighting over in Iraq for democracy. Well, there's another book you really need to get. There's a DVD. The DVD is Riddles in Stone. It's an award-winning DVD which is available through Radio Liberty. And there's a book written by Mandy P. Hall, who was a Luciferian. And the book is called The Secret Destiny of America. And Mandy P. Hall, who died in the early 1990s, will tell you that for thousands of years, at least 3,000 years, there have been secret societies working to bring about world democracy. And that's why we're fighting in the Middle East today. And you think we're fighting there for freedom for the Iraqi people? We've established if you read the Iraqi Constitution, we've established a authoritarian socialist state under Sharia law there. There's no freedom. Everything is under Sharia law, which is the traditional Muslim law, very, very strict. The Christians have been driven out of Iraq. I think they're only, they had 10%. The population was Christian. Now it's down to 3%, and the remaining 3% is trying to get out. They would leave if they could. Those who remain behind are being slaughtered thanks to the Constitution we brought to power there. Under the wicked Saddam Hussein, they could live, they could prosper, and they were accepted in society. That's no longer the case now that we've liberated Iraq. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a real problem today because people don't understand what is going on. They do not understand that there is an agenda that's going to very soon draw us into a war with the entire Islamic world, as the leaders of our nation use the military and financial power of the United States to bring about a new world order, a new world religion, a new world leader. Well, you certainly need to get the other things that are available for Radio Liberty. Let me suggest some of our four tape sets. The Changing Church. These are four tape or four CD sets. Globalism, The Secret Threat. The Impending Police State goes into the background of the Military Commission Act and the John Warner Defense Appropriation Act and all the moves being taken today to move us away from freedom towards an authoritarian society. Gets into the building of the concentration camps in America. Incidentally, we have a four-tape set on concentration camps. We have a concentration camp special where you'll actually see the camps. You'll see the congressional hearings where Congressman Jack Brooks was trying to bring out the fact that there was a plan in case of a national emergency to suspend the Constitution and put Americans into those camps. You'll actually see Congressman Henry Gonzalez, longtime Democratic chairman of the House Banking Committee, saying there is a plan in case of a national emergency to suspend the Constitution and put Americans into camps. People say it couldn't happen here, and I would ask, why not? If God is just, do you think his justice will sleep forever? Our telephone number, 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927, and we'll be back in just a moment at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and for this hour, the views of Mr. Arthur Bernclau from Veterans for Constitutional Law. And Arthur is a veterans advocate for many years. Of course, we've sent our boys overseas to fight in no-win wars, for the aggrandizement of this idea of bringing about this new world order. And of course, it was a no-win war in Vietnam. It was a no-win war in Korea. And it's a no-win war that's being fought in Iraq today. If we really wanted to have won the war, we would have brought in adequate troops to begin with. We sending 697,000 troops in 1991, 140,000 in the year 2003 to not only conquer Iraq but to occupy it. And we wait 4 years down the line, and then suddenly, oh my goodness, we need more troops. We're going to have a surge. And then now, of course, we're going to have our 7,000 troops home by Christmas, and we're going to cut back 7 of the 30,000 we've increased, and that's supposedly a victory for sanity. And our boys continue dying. But when they come home crippled, when they come home psychologically impaired, or those, about a third of the young men who are being sent overseas, within 3 months of the time they return to the United States, are ill with some undiagnosed illness. And when they go to the Veterans Administration for help, why, they get the runaround. And that's where Arthur comes in. Arthur, thank you so much for being with us tonight. How are things doing with the Veterans for Constitutional Law?
They're doing very well since that lawsuit has been started. There are more and more veterans joining that lawsuit every single day.
What does it tell us about the lawsuit?
Okay, I'd like to speak first about a Marine. Won't take much time here, and then I'll get right into the lawsuit. Veterans Marine begins the fight of his life. This is a story by Barbara Barrett of the McClatchy News Service, McClatchy Newspapers. And McClatchy Newspapers has been very, very cooperative with the veterans of this country in exposing what's going on with the Veterans Administration and what's going on with the entire administration here in Washington. And they've been like a breath of fresh air to the media. McClatchy News Service, those are the people who bought out Knight Ridder. Knight Ridder sold out to McClatchy, and McClatchy has become a pleasant surprise. Marine Sergeant David D.J. Emery, Jr., his life snapped into focus on the morning of April 23rd, 2 days after his little baby girl was born. He studied the lower half of his hospital bed and then turned to his mother, and still unable to speak, mouthed this question: "What happened to my legs?" Now, for weeks, the young warrior's mother, his young wife, and the doctors in the intensive care unit of the Bethesda National Naval Medical Center outside of Washington, it's in Bethesda, Maryland, had kept him clinging to this side of death. But when Emery discovered that morning that his legs were gone, the fight became his, and he hates it. It hurts when the physical therapist pushes hard on his stumps. He seals his eyes shut and blows a long, slow curse through his lips like air seeping from a punctured tire. He's humiliated when he tries to lift his body into a sitting position, loses his balance, and nearly tumbles onto the ground. He utters more curses and throws whatever
is
lying.
Hold this. Okay, fine. Go ahead, Arthur.
Okay. He utters more curses and throws whatever is lying nearby with his only good limb, the left-handed Emery's right arm. I hate having to depend on people, Emery said last week, his voice quiet and raspy. He was lying on his stomach and being attended to by a physical therapist and his mother, Connie, and his wife, Leslie. He glanced over at little Carly Ann, 2 months old now, and testing a new smile from the bed of a stroller. He has to learn the same motor skills as she does. Rolling over, sitting up, propelling himself from one point to another. And he's vowed to walk before she does. Emery of Belafonte, Pennsylvania, is one of a growing number of double amputees who are now at Walter Reed Army Medical Center. He was transferred over earlier this month. They're victims of the improvised explosive devices that are becoming more and more powerful as the Iraq war continues. One afternoon last week, four other double amputees, all of them further along in their recoveries, exercised their stumps or treated their new mechanical legs in the physical therapy room as Emery went through his exercises. He remembers little about what happened to him on February 7th at Anbar province, the hotbed of Iraq's Sunni Muslim insurgency and its Al-Qaeda-linked terrorists. He was at a checkpoint. He stopped to chat with other Marines while Iraqi soldiers searched anybody who didn't seem right. He never saw the suspicious-looking man whose torso was wrapped in explosives. The man spread his arms wide like a bird taking flight and triggered the blast. Emery doesn't recall the flight home, the countless surgeries, the amputations, first of one leg and then of the other. But on April 23rd, when he discovered his legs were gone, he took up his fight. He began to heal. Through good days and bad, he moved from the intensive care unit at Bethesda to a regular hospital room and then 2 weeks ago to Ward 57, the amputee's home at Walter Reed. He's been visited by the Washington Redskins football team, by his congressman, Representative John Peterson, and by President Bush, who gave Emery his Purple Heart. I don't know, he's just another person, you know, Emery recalled from his bed. He invited me to the White House. Hopefully I can get some running legs and go running with him and smoke his behind. The encounters that really matter to Emery are the ones with the other veterans, such as the old man in the hallway who gets around better on two artificial legs than most senior citizens do on real ones. When a doctor tells you that you'll walk one day and he has two real legs, you're like, whatever. Emery said, but when a guy comes in on two prosthetic legs...
Oh, hold that thought right there.
Sure.
Well, Arthur's been reading his story, but Arthur, it'd be far better if you just really the reading of that. If there's any way we could just get to what the point is, we have so many crippled people coming back. It's not those that are dying
right now.
So many that are coming back with one or two or even three limbs gone, and of course this is what's this all about.
Yeah,
and then of course, what happens to these fellows after? Of course, they. After they get through their rehabilitation, how do they make a living? How do they fit into society? What happens to their families? What happens to their wives? What happens to their parents? So go ahead from there.
In most cases, Dr. Stan, they don't fit into society. In most cases, it's a disaster.
It is. And, Chris, why are we fighting another... For instance, I would like to just let our listeners know that there are vehicles. They're put out by force protection. To my knowledge, nobody has ever been injured or killed in a force protection, vehicle. They could mass produce these. I can remember during the Second World War when we were able to build an entire ship in one day, but we just can't get around to building the adequate vehicles to protect our men over there in Iraq. Oh, we just don't have the right equipment. No. As Rumsfeld said, you go to war with the equipment you have. Well, ladies and gentlemen, I don't think you ought to go to war if you can't protect your fighting men. Go ahead, Arthur.
Well, back in those days, Dr. Stan, we had some pride in ourselves. That's the difference right there. The encounters that really matter to Emery... When a doctor tells you that you'll walk one day and he has two real legs, you're like, whatever, Emery said. But when a guy comes in on two prosthetic legs... and they're standing there, it makes everything possible. Now, Emery wants to be that guy someday, standing in the hallway and talking to a fresh kid from Iraq. And Emery used to be 6'3", and today he thinks he'd be happy at an even 6'. He has very far to go. If you look at him on paper, he's a complete train wreck, said Dr. J. Pyle, an Army captain and Emory's osteopathic doctor. Emory is skinny, weak, and recovering from multiple organ failure. His left arm remains in a brace, all but useless. His left leg was amputated at the hip, his right leg just below. Those are especially difficult spots for somebody who must learn to walk again with prosthetic limbs. On his first day in physical therapy 2 weeks ago, therapist Adele Levine felt Emory's tight muscles and wondered about his prognosis. He has almost no abdominal muscles because of a stomach wound, no core to control sitting up, swiveling, and someday taking steps. But last week, she felt the growing bicep of his right arm and watched hand poised at his back as Emory grimaced, tried to sit up, swinging a hip, pushing off with one arm, and cursing at the effort. I can't swing it. It's impossible, he said. I can't get up. Levine patted his shoulder. It's okay. Let's try again. She counted to three. He grunted, twisted, grimaced, and sat. Levine stretched his hip muscles. A pain that feels good, Emory said, because he knows his body's working. I do think he's doing really incredible, considering how he did when he first came in, Levine said. Emory's getting used to the idea of fatherhood. He fed little Carly for the first time a week ago. He hasn't changed dirty diapers yet, figuring the whole daddy thing will hit home when he does. He was scheduled to be fitted for prosthetics at the end of the week. Maybe in a few days, he'll be ready to move to a nearby military apartment, giving him outpatient status. It's a big step. I look at it this way, he said in a quiet voice. I pretty much, like, have been aware of things since April 23rd when I realized I didn't have legs. From lying in that bed in the ICU to here is pretty good. He cradled Carly in his bad arm. It seems like it's been forever. He tipped his daughter's baby bottle with the good arm and watched her tiny feet pummel the air. And,
Well, there's just so many tragedies out there, Arthur. Really? And I'm sure this is simply one of thousands of similar stories of men who have been sent over there to fight and bleed and suffer and die, but never to be allowed to win because of the rules of engagement, because of inadequate equipment, because, of course, there were never enough men there initially to win and to occupy and to hold, and because, of course, the war is being run from Washington, D.C., but not by the men on the ground and not by the officers there. And this is why this whole situation is so tragic, and more and more and more of our men are coming back. And our facilities, we do not have the medical facilities and the rehab facilities and the funding to really take care of them. So go right ahead. What's happening to these men?
And Mr. Bush says we're going to be there another decade.
We're going to be there forever. We have no intention of pulling our men out. Nope. In fact, both he and General Petraeus have said our men are going to stay on there, and that's what it was always about. What's happening to these men when they come back? What happens when they, get into the clutches of the Veterans Administration? Are they able to get the adequate compensation, enough money for them and their families to live on?
No, they're not. And people are now calling General Petraeus General Betrayus. That's what they're calling him now. Now, on that lawsuit that I was going to start to talk about. Now, frustrated by delays, and I have to credit this to Hope Yen, the Associated Press writer. Frustrated by delays in health care, a coalition of injured Iraq war veterans is accusing VA Secretary Jim Nicholson of breaking the law by denying them disability pay and health treatment. And the class action lawsuit, which was filed in July, against the United States Department of Veterans Affairs, the VA, in federal court San Francisco, seeks broad change in the agency as it struggles to meet growing demands from veterans returning home from Iraq and Afghanistan. And we can't take care of the ones that are coming back here. They're overwhelmed and we can't take care of them. And they're suing on behalf of hundreds of thousands of veterans, They're expecting the suit to grow to a minimum of 800,000 veterans on here.
800,000 veterans that would be entitled to disability benefits, and there's no more money. I understood Mr. Nicholson has resigned, is that right?
He has resigned, but that's not going to stop him from going on trial, nor is it going to stop Mr. Gonzalez for going on trial, because he has been named as a co-defendant, and I submitted somewhere between 200 and 300 pages of information to Gordon Erspammer, the chief litigant, on Mr. Anthony Principi, the former secretary of the VA, who shipped $1.2 billion worth of Veterans Administration money to his own company.
$1.2 billion?
$1.2 billion.
In other words, he was the former director, and then, because he went into the private sector and then shifted the money that should have gone to take care of these veterans who fought for our country into his own coffers.
Well, the way he did it was... 24 hours before becoming the secretary of the VA, he received a $250,000 check from his own company, QTC. And that was like a bonus or a commission to quadruple the contract for physical evaluations from the VA over to his own company, QTC. Now, the difference was, Dr. Stan, when an evaluation is done by QTC, the evaluation is not done by an MD. It's done by a clerk at the QTC company, and the government is billed $495 per evaluation.
And I suppose these are simply evaluations on physical disability and will be used then to determine whether or not the veteran's entitled to benefits?
Exactly. And also on all returning veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq, the physicals that they get back, that when they come back, that they have to get the physical here in the States.
Now, of course, it could be done by the Veterans Administration for what about...
At the cost of $89.80, not $495.
All right. In other words, basically, this is simply another example of a ripoff.
$1 billion
or more by a private company, by somebody who worked for government.
Yeah. Now, I took this to the Justice Department several times. I took it to the Justice Department. And Mr. Gonzalez quoted me, quote unquote, "We can't touch Principi. He's too high up on the food chain."
Now, of course, did you actually speak to Mr.
Gonzalez? I finally spoke to him, and that's what he told me. He's too high up on the food chain. And I said, maybe someday you and him could share a cell. And when I said that, he got a little antagonistic, and he said, "What do you got against Mr. Principi? He's a very nice guy." I said, "I have nothing personal against them. I'm doing this so I can have something for my trivia collection. I'd love a license plate made by him and Stir." And at that point, he hung up on me.
All right, fine.
Anyway, now, suing on behalf of hundreds of thousands of veterans. Now, the lawsuit charges that the VA has failed warriors on several fronts, from providing prompt disability benefits, to adding staff to reduce wait times for medical care, to boosting services for post-traumatic stress disorder.
And now, basically, then what they've been doing is funneling off the veterans, money that should be going to the veterans, to Mr. Principi and other government employees?
Exactly. It also accuses the VA of deliberately cheating some veterans by allegedly working with the Pentagon to misclassify post-traumatic stress disorder claims as pre-existing personality disorders to avoid paying out benefits.
And I think this is a very important thing. I don't know what is it. Tens of thousands, apparently, of veterans have been put into this classification. Pre-existing personality disorders. Now,
22,500.
How many?
22,500.
Right. And, of course, once you do that, then they're not entitled to any compensation. They don't have to have had a pre-existing personality disorder. This is simply a way of cheating them out of any Veterans Administration benefits. And this is what we're really up against. When you got corruption at the highest levels of government, after all, if the money went to the veterans, it could go to Mr. Principi and his gang. And I wonder if Alberto Gonzalez was on the... Well, we don't know. At least he would not do anything. We'll be right back. So you pick up the story there, Arthur.
Okay, the attorneys at Morrison & Foster, that's the law firm, Morrison & Foster, LLP, assure me that that the 22,500 veterans are going to have those cases reversed. By law, they were not allowed to do that, and they did it. So they assure me that they are confident they're going to reverse those 22,500 cases, and that is great news. That is the best news I've heard yet out of it. And
so when will the other case be going to court? And that's the one for that deals with all the other things that are going on. Are they specifically going to bring a lawsuit against Mr. Principe for his malfeasance in office and for funding all the money to his own private corporation?
Well, they're determining that right now. I've sent them between 200 and 300 pages on what Mr. Principe has done, going all the way back to the way he hid depleted uranium for between 4 to 5 years, and he hid that from the public. I've gone all the way back on there. I've sent them a multitude of information, and I hope they use it all. And the VA spokesman, Matt Smith, said he can't comment on a pending lawsuit, but he gave us the baloney that the agency is committed to meeting the special needs of war veterans. Now,
Arthur, are you talking about the fact that many of the veterans have been exposed to depleted uranium? Is this the material?
Yep. I submitted that to them also, and Mr. Principe was responsible for withholding that information from the public for between 4 to 5 years.
All right, fine.
That's what forced him to resign initially when the scientists in Europe, the European scientists, came up with all the data on this, and Mr. Principe had no choice but to resign and get out.
All right, fine. Of course, for our listeners out there, you must understand that certainly throughout the rest of the world, everybody knows that the dangers of the depleted uranium shells, 50-caliber machine gun shells, and certainly rockets and bombs and missiles and other things that we're using, which, of course, actually releases depleted uranium dust. It gets into the pulmonary system and plays havoc with the bodies of so many of our people, and I'm sure many of the returning veterans here are actually poisoned by depleted uranium. But the Veterans Administration refuses to acknowledge what the rest of the world knows is taking place. Go ahead, Arthur.
No, they won't. Anyway, through outreach efforts, the VA ensures returning Global War on Terror service members have access to widely recognized quality health care that they've earned, including services like prosthetics and mental health care. And this is what the VA tells us. The VA has also given priority handling to their monetary disability benefits claims. What baloney this is. Now, the lawsuit comes amid intense political and public scrutiny of the VA and Pentagon following reports of shoddy outpatient care of injured soldiers at Walter Reed Hospital, Medical Center, and the VA hospitals. Now, unless systemic and drastic measures are instituted immediately, the cost to these veterans, their families, and our nations will be incalculable, including broken families, a new generation of unemployed and homeless veterans, increases in drug abuse and alcoholism, and crushing burdens on the health care delivery system. The complaint states, and it asks the federal court order that...
Hold that right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Arthur, go right ahead. Just sort of basically summarize what you were saying about this lawsuit. And we have hundreds of thousands of homeless veterans in America. Do you have any idea how many we have?
It's hard to keep track of it now. It's mushroomed so widely, it's hard to keep track anymore.
I mean, the figure I heard the other day, I think it was 200,000. Homeless veterans now.
Oh, no, it's way in excess of
that. Go back to Vietnam, and some of them, of course, would be the first Gulf War and now the second Gulf War. And remember, we only lost 100 men in battle. But, of course, almost a third of the people who came back after that were ill after the war. We never tell the American people about all the people who contracted the Gulf War illness as if it didn't exist. But you're dealing with...
Last I heard, it was up to around 320-some-odd
thousand. 320,000.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Now, it asked the federal court to order the VA to make immediate improvements that would speed disability payments, ensure fairness in awards, and provide more complete access to health care, including mental health care. And the Department of Defense and the VA keeps refusing requests to add more PTSD counselors. They keep refusing to do this. And earlier this month, the Federal Appeals Court in San Francisco issued a strong rebuke of the VA in ordering the agency to pay retroactive benefits to Vietnam War veterans who were exposed to Agent Orange and contracted a form of leukemia. The court has told the VA that they've got to make good for this now. So things are happening over there right now. Now, the performance of the United States Department of Veterans Affairs has contributed substantially to our sense of national shame. In the opinion from the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals read, Nicholson abruptly announced last week he would step down by October 1st and return to the private sector.
This
and
is
he
Jim
has,
Nicholson, who was the, was he the secretary of the VA? What was his official title?
Yeah, he's the secretary of the VA currently, and they haven't gotten a replacement for him yet. He's supposed to step down by October 1st and return to the private sector. I hope he looks good in the stripes. Anyway, he has repeatedly defended the agency during his 2.5-year tenure while acknowledging there was room for improvement. Now, more recently, following high-profile suicide incidents in which families of veterans say the VA did not provide adequate care, Nicholson pledged to add mental health services and hire more suicide prevention coordinators. That has not happened. Some veterans say those measures aren't enough in the lawsuit. They note that the government investigators warned as early as 2002 that the VA needed to fix its backlog claim system and make other changes. They're estimating that's up to 770,000 veterans backlog claims.
Let's just repeat that. 770,000 veterans have claims that they just haven't got around to looking at yet. What do you do when you get out of the military and you're crippled and you can't work? Why,
not
we
much.
Put you on the waiting list. You're one of the 770,001. We'll get around to you sometime. And they were saying that they're going to just take care of this in a few weeks or a few months. But are they really doing what they promise?
No, and the VA says, the VA admits to that it's over 600,000. They admit it's over 600,000. Until just recently, they were claiming it's under 400,000. So now they're admitting it's over 600,000, but it is actually up over 770,000.
All right, fine. What is
and some veterans say the measures aren't enough. In a lawsuit, they note that the government... the lawsuit says Nicholson and other officials still insisted on a budget in 2005 that fell $1 billion short, that they made a mockery of the rule of law by awarding senior officials of the VA $3.8 million in bonuses despite their role in the budget follow-up, and many of these people who got these bonuses sat on the committees that voted themselves the bonuses. Now, delays are up to 177 days to process an initial claim. 177 days, that's 6 months. And an average of 657 days to process an appeal. That's 2 years. And several congressional committees and a presidential commission are now studying ways to improve this. And we're not too optimistic about these commissions.
No, of course, the thing is, in the past, well, you applied and then you got a hearing and then they turned you down. What percentage of the people are actually getting a favorable responses when they make the claim? What
4%.
4%.
Yep, they're hiding it. They're saying it's between 11 to 12 to 13, but they call it VA creative mathematics.
And about 4%, according to Arthur, of the people who put in a claim get it, and then, of course, you have to appeal. There's another 2 years.
That is correct, yeah. Now let the...
Hold that, Arthur.
Okay.
All right, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Arthur Burnclough. Go ahead, Arthur.
Okay, in an article in the National Law Journal, the wounded soldiers who allege the government is downplaying their injuries and cheating them out of benefits have some new legal ammunition. There are three major law firms offering free legal services, aside from the lawsuit out in San Francisco. Now, concerned that injured soldiers are getting a raw deal upon returning home, three firms, Foley and Lardner, Atlanta's King and Spalding, and New York's LeBoff, Lamb, Green, and McRae, they have offered to do pro bono work on behalf of veterans who are appealing low disability ratings made by the government. And it's starting to grow now, Dr. Stan.
Well, I think for our listeners out there, they have to understand that in the past, why the veterans could not get legal consultation, they were prevented by law from getting it. So, of course, they would get into this system. The government would have, what, a couple of thousand lawyers against this one poor veteran who can't even get a
12,000 lawyers.
12,000 lawyers on one side, no lawyers on the other.
Exactly.
And they're going to go into the system with a judge who, of course, has been selected by the government to protect the government. But anyway, now we have a new legislation.
Yep.
I think that's wonderful. These law firms are going to help the veterans.
Well, I'll have to say Veterans for Constitutional Law played a major part in getting this new legislation passed. We played a major part in there. We were on them day and night.
And I think that's really, for our listeners out there, most of your mainline veterans organizations, the American Legion, and Disabled American Veterans,
the Veterans of Foreign Wars, Vietnam Veterans of America, AMVETS, Paralyzed Veterans of America, they all fought it. Every one of the chartered service organizations fought it. They didn't want lawyers. They said, you got us. You don't need lawyers.
That, of course,
sure. We had them. 4% of the veterans were collecting.
Right. And so now the new legislation allows the veteran to get a lawyer, and the lawyers be coming forward and volunteering to help.
Yeah.
And certainly these people who
and this,
fought for our
this
country.
Lawsuit out in San Francisco in the Ninth Circuit, unless we pass this lawsuit would not have taken place.
Right.
And the ratings dictate how much money injured veterans are entitled to along with any medical and retirement benefits. And according to attorneys, numerous veterans at Walter Reed Army Medical Center who served in Iraq and Afghanistan have claimed that the military is purposely underrating their injuries.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest is Arthur Burnclough, Veterans for Constitutional Law. Before we go on, Arthur, I want you to get your telephone number and your web page out there so people will know how to get in touch with you and get help, because we have veterans all across the country who are caught up in this corrupt system, and, of course, they need somebody to talk to, somebody can steer them right. So how can people get in touch with you and your organization where the people all operate and donate their time because they just want to help?
Okay, basically the best way is to either write our address or write our telephone number. Now, Pastor Dave Tartaschini has set up a web page for me. I don't even know my web page, but he set one up for me right now, and he says he's taking care of that for me. And the best way to contact us is either to write Veterans for Constitutional Law Limited at 112 Jefferson Avenue in Port Jefferson, New York, and it's 11777, and we're always open for calls, telephone calls, 631-474-4261, or if you can get our website, Veterans for Constitutional Law Limited. I don't know the website I'm not much with a computer. In fact, my computer is laying on the floor in 200 pieces right now.
But I do want you to get that website. So next time we hit you on, Arthur, you'll be able to give that because it'll be
so absolutely.
Much
I'll get that out to you. But I want to give you a website for Morrison and Foster for veterans who are listening now who want to get their cases over and get themselves legal representation. And Morrison and Foster's website, Gordon Erspammer, the chief litigator, it's GERSPAMER at MOFO, M-O-F-O, .com. And his telephone number, talk to him in person, would be 925-295-3341. And he is in charge of the lawsuit. He's the chief litigator there. And another man is Russell K. Terry, the CEO and the founder of Iraq War Veterans Organization. And his telephone number is 909-494-6218. And his web is webmaster at iraqwarveterans.org.
iraqwarveterans.org. Okay, fine.
And another man is another attorney, NVLSP, National Veterans Legal Service Project, Ronald B. Abrams. He's the deputy director, and his number is 202-265-8305, and his email is Ron, R-O-N-A-B-R-A-M-S, at NVLSP.org.
All right, I think it'll be easy if people would just call Arthur and get the information. Your telephone number one more time, and they'll have to get those from you, Arthur.
Okay, and my telephone number is 631, area code 474-4261, and I'm available all the time to anybody who wants to talk to me about it. And if you're looking for a charity to donate to, there's nobody better than us. We're out there on the front lines, and we're fighting every single day.
All right, fine. And Sydney, we've heard very good reports from many veterans who've really been helped. And veterans need somebody to help them because they're caught in a bureaucratic system where all the odds are against them. Well, it's encouraging now to know that, Sydney, the veterans will be able to have legal representation. And hopefully before long, more than 4% will get something done for them first time around. And then after they have their appeal and it takes 2 years, what percentage then do get some compensation?
Generally, it's pretty much at 4% unless you get them into a court. When you get them into a court, that figure jumps up into the 30s.
All right, fine. Now, of course, what about the people who are regular Army? Do they get an Army pension different than a veteran's pension?
Yes. Yeah, they get a... regular people who have served 20 to 30 years get their regular pension, but for years and years, they would not pay a disability to anybody injured and their retirement pension. Until we had a law passed, they passed a compromise law about 3 years ago on there that they had to phase all of these people in that they get both of them. So they're phasing them in over 10 years, but they're going to court again because they're claiming the VA, who is supposed to be phasing them in over 10 years, has found a million ways to cheat veterans out of getting their money at all.
All right, fine. Now,
so they're going to court again on the same thing.
All right, so basically, of course, if you are regular Army, now what happens if you're regular Army, you join the regular Army, and you've only been in for, say, 5 years, and you have a permanent disability? Did you get an Army pension, or
nope.
Do you have to go to the Veterans Administration?
Nope, you got to go to the Veterans Administration, and you got to go through the fight, and you've got to apply, and you got to be turned down two or three or four dozen times.
All right, so it's a game that they play, and because actually, are they still giving them these large bonuses to the people who turn down the most veterans?
They've cut that out to a certain extent, but they are still getting bonuses. They're a little more underhanded now. It's not being published as much. It's not being publicized as much. as it was before, but they're still giving out the bonuses to people who are turning down veteran claims, because that's right. The VA stock and trade.
All right, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. That's 464-8295. If you have a question for Arthur, who's really on the front lines of this battle. So when do you think that this major lawsuit will actually get into court, where they're going to actually go after Mr. Principe, where they're going to go after Jim Nicholson and the other people who have been conspiring to, in my estimation at least, to keep the veterans from being able to get the compensation that was due to them?
Oh, it'll get into court shortly, but I have an idea this trial is going to run a long, long time, because there's going to be a lot more people dragged into this. Like they've already brought in the man who was in charge of the VA Health Service, Dr. Cussman. They've already brought in Rear Admiral Cooper, who was in charge of the benefits, and they brought in quite a few regional directors of the VA. So more and more people are being brought into this. And we expect this trial to run for a long time, and there's going to be a lot of dirt uncovered that people have known about, but it hasn't been publicized by our media too much.
Well, how much does the Veterans Administration have? What's the budget of the Veterans Administration for taking care of veterans and providing disability for them?
I'm not exactly sure. It's a figure that's changing all the time.
Are the current administration making any provision for all of these veterans in coming home? Because what I
not really no
that they had never expected there'd been so many people coming back crippled or coming back with permanent injuries and disabilities. So that, my goodness, they just don't have the money, and that's the excuse that's given. We can't give them the money; we don't have it, and if it's not budgeted,
well, look at
no
what we're spending in Iraq, Dr. Stan. If we take some of that money we're spending in Iraq and try and help our war wounded, those problems could be solved.
But we've got to keep our people there for 10, 20, 30, 40 years, like we kept them in Germany for 60 years. And
well, that's
Japan
what the oil
for
is.
60 years, and they've already said, the President and General Petraeus have said, we've got to keep our troops there in Iraq for a good long while. That means really forever.
You're a reasonable man. I'm a reasonable man. Can you think of a reasonable reason why we have to keep them there? I can't.
That was the original plan. It was laid out back in the year 2000 in a pamphlet put out by the Project for the New American Century. Anybody can get it from their website, newamericancentury.org. That's newamericancentury.org. A pamphlet there, published there by the neocons who control our government, and of course it's called Rebuilding America's Defenses, and I think it's on page 14, although I could be mistaken.
That's another guy we
say
have to
that
get
they're
to.
Going to keep our people there indefinitely. It doesn't matter whether Saddam Hussein is there or not. We will have American troops permanently stationed, certainly in the Middle East. But we've got Steve calling from Illinois. Oh. Steve, do you have a question for our guest? Steve?
Hello?
Go ahead. Do you have a question for our guest?
Yes, Dr. Stan, I love your program. Something that bothers me, I know we've given a lot of money out to a certain client state of ours. That's one thing. But the other thing is, there is $4 trillion with a T missing or unaccounted for, or they won't account for, Bush administration of defense spending. Why on earth aren't people clamoring about this? That would help our veterans and everything else.
Of course.
Nobody brings them to call on it.
I don't think it was $4 trillion. I think they'd only lost a trillion or two there at the Defense Department.
Oh, no, no. No, it's over $4 trillion. And that's just been in 6 years since Bush has been in. And nobody calls them on it, and just drives them up a wall when that goes on, and that's taken away from our veterans and our country as a whole. And people need to get this addressed or something. Democrats or nobody is saying anything about it, and it's ridiculous.
The thing is that the current budget is about $485 or $95 billion a year. So, and Bush has only been in for 7 years. So, seven times, even if everything was lost, that would only be about $3.5 trillion over that length of time. I really don't think it's up much, but certainly it may very well be $1 trillion or more. Maybe maybe even more than that has been lost. Nobody knows what happened to the money in the Defense Department, and that is disturbing, isn't it, Arthur?
It's extremely disturbing to me, and I'd like to add something said by Cindy Sheehan about another gentleman that you had mentioned at one time or another here, a fellow by the name of Mr. William Crystal.
Oh, Mr. William Crystal,
who's
the director of the project for the New
American
Center.
That's right. He's another dishonorable chicken hawk, and this was said by Cindy Sheehan. And she said, I know just a little bit about Mr. William Crystal. He is the son of one of the founders of the neoconservative movement, Irving Crystal. He is a commentator on Fox News. He was chief of staff of one of the political geniuses of our time, Vice President Dan Quayle. He is editor of another Rupert Murdoch war propaganda rag, the Weekly Standard. He is a member and signer of the Project for the New American Century, which I think you know, Dr. Stan.
Right, that was the website I just gave out.
Exactly, which is a game plan for U.S. global hegemony based on military strength, and one of its goals and objectives was the overthrow of the Hussein regime in Iraq, with the next stop in Iran and Syria, because the PNAC plan is going so well so far with Mr. Bush. By all accounts, Mr. Crystal is a brilliant man who, like his father before him, uses his brilliance for destruction. He is a shameless supporter of a failed, murderous, and miserable strategy in Iraq and Afghanistan, and one of the mushroom cloud crowd. One thing Mr. William Crystal is not is a combat vet. Although he was born in 1952, he never served during Vietnam. I'm sure while at Harvard, he was a staunch supporter of the American effort to enrich the war profiteers, while ostensibly stopping that war's enemy, communism, from spreading across Asia. Secure in his studies during that quagmire, Crystal joins a long line of neocon chicken hawks who are drenched in other people's blood and love to send other people's children to die for their lies. Now, I don't know anything or care to know anything about Mr. Crystal's private life. I don't care if he's another closeted gay Republican or happily married hetero with children. I do suspect, however, that if Mr. Crystal is married, his children are not serving in Iraq, being misused by the very same incompetent and cowardly commander-in-chief, who also did not serve in Vietnam, that Mr. Crystal shamelessly supports, while the entire administration and Republican hypocrites are crumbling from corruption and scandal. I do know that one thing for sure about Mr. Crystal, he does not like to be bothered with those pesky little things called facts. On February 20th, 2003, Mr. Crystal incredibly gushed, "If we free the people of Iraq, we will be respected in the Arab world." This statement shows an amazing lack of knowledge of the Arab world or any kind of foreign policy sophistication, but does show a great use of Rovian, Foxian exploitation of emotion. Nobody in the Arab world, except maybe Israel, which is geographically located in the Arab world, was calling for the U.S. to free Iraqis. Nobody from Iraq, except Curveball or the slimy prophet-motivated Ahmad Shalabi, both Iraqis, weren't even living in the country at the time of the invasion, were calling the USA to liberate them. In fact, after many years of murderous sanctions against Iraq, a fierce nationalism arose in opposition to the U.S.-UN-led sanctions. According to national intelligence estimates, since the illegal and immoral invasion of Iraq, Islamic jihadism has increased. Mr. Crystal is also incredibly ignorant of human nature and human history, and no peoples like to be occupied, no child, brother, sister, mother, or father who sees a loved one blown away by American or insurgents' bombs will love the oppressor. In fact, violence only creates more violence and more lifelong enemies, and now Mr. Crystal is safe behind his desk and computer calling for another attack against Iran. I think he hears the non-existent cries of the Iranian people to be liberated from their regime, and the Iranian people are directly next door to Iraq, and they see what U.S. liberation brings. It comes with the awful price of high civilian casualties, hospitals bombed, doctors killed, no electricity or clean water, and eternal occupation. And in a recent op-ed for the Weekly Standard, Mr. Crystal makes many more tactical and fundamental errors. The ANSA coalition is calling for mass mobilizations beginning the week of September 15th, that's tomorrow, and that the White House authorized Petraeus report on the surges due. Members of the Iraq Veterans Against the War, who are leading the September 15th march, are calling for a die-in to end the march and begin the rally. The vets, unlike the chicken hawk neocons, have actually served in the war, particularly the one Mr. Crystal imagines is such a success, and is asking activists to represent a killed service member and an appropriate time lie-down.
All right, fine. Well, of course, if anybody would like to know the answer, what should we have done? We should have let the Iraqi people overthrow Saddam Hussein. If you read the book, which we carry, See No Evil by Robert Baer, a former CIA agent, he will tell you that in his 5 years in Iraq, on two occasions, the Iraqi military wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and on each occasion, the American State Department intervened, betrayed the generals, and they and their families were tortured to death. Why would our State Department be so intent upon keeping Saddam Hussein in power? The book, See No Evil, by Robert Baer. Well, let's go ahead. You've got 3 minutes to wrap up the program, Arthur.
Okay. Anyway, very few wars in American history were prepared better or more thoroughly than this one by our president. And Cindy Sheehan says, I would laugh if I weren't crying so hard. If Mr. Crystal gets his PNAC way, by this time next year, we'll need a lot more people at a die-in. And God bless her. She's running for Congress.
Well, you know, she might just make it, because I think that certainly by next year, if we're still in this war, and I fear we will be, that there are going to be a lot of people in Nancy Pelosi's district who, and Cindy's running against Nancy Pelosi, that there will be a lot of people in that district who will vote for anybody rather than Nancy Pelosi.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes,
definitely. The thing is that Cindy Sheehan was campaigning for the Democrats, saying, you know, elect the Democrats, they'll get us out of Iraq. And, of course, when the Democrats got in office, it was more of the same. So, to her credit, she's going to run against Nancy Pelosi, and she's going to bring out, obviously, a lot about the Project for the New American Century, simply another front for the power elite. But they've got a website up there, Project for the New American Century, their website, newamericancentury.org. Go there, understand everything going on today was planned long before the 9/11 attack. It was sure a very, very convenient thing that that attack came when it did, and that those 19 hijackers, certainly armed with their little tiny box-cutter knives, were able to thwart the entire American intelligence organization, hijack 4 planes, and of course, they just happened to do it on the very day when America was having a stand-down and all sorts of the military stand-down, so there were no fighter planes in the air, and where we were having, I think, somewhere between 5 and 10 military exercises, some of which simulated a hijacked plane crashing into a government building. If you want the documentation, give us a call. We'll get it. Arthur, your parting thought before we let you go.
Okay. There's been a... charges made against the VA now and against the United States Navy about the distilling of water for ships which were docked off Vietnam. There were 79 ships there, and we were distilling water from a contaminated area, and many, many people are getting sick, and they are now bringing charges against the Navy and against the VA.
We're out of time. God bless you. Thanks very much, Arthur. We'll look forward to talking to you again sometime.
My pleasure, Dr. Stan, and thank you for having me.
Well, this is Dr. Stan. I hope you enjoyed our conversation with Arthur. A lot of good information there. And you have to understand how the veterans are being misused. So, our job is to get the information out, and hopefully that you'll call your congressmen and your senators and demand that something be done to protect our senators, to protect our servicemen. The other thing is, I hope that you'll call your senators and congressmen and demand that we not go to war with Iran, that they withdraw any permission that they've given, and that they openly acknowledge that if the president, you know, takes us into a war with Iran, he is going to get impeached. It's the only thing we can do at this time to try to stop this insanity, and then pray that we do not go to war with Iran, because this could very well end up being a war with the entire Islamic world. How did we get into the mess we are? Well, we carry several books. One is called The Devil's Game. It goes into the background of how the CIA created Al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden. We carry have a book called See No Evil by Robert Baer, who was a CIA agent working in Iraq, who said he never met an Iraqi who did not believe that the United States was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. And there were, he cites two instances, one which is believed by the Iraqi people, another one he personally witnessed, where members of the Iraqi military wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and our State Department blocked that. Why would they do that? Because the American State Department is controlled by an organization known as the Council on Foreign Relations, which is an extension of a secret society that was created in 1891 by a Cecil John Rhodes, for whom Rhodesia is named, and certainly the man who was responsible for De Beers Diamonds, Anglo-American Minerals, and one of the richest men in the world, and his fortune lives on, and his influence lives on. And he was dedicated to the creation of a world government. If you have not read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to. And, of course, we get you into the background of Cecil Rhodes and the background of the Council on Foreign Relations, another excellent book written by Bill Clinton's mentor, Tragedy and Hope, A History of the World in Our Time. It's 1,342 pages, but it's one of the most important books you'll ever read, and you get it by itself, or we call it the Tragedy and Hope Special, with a copy of another suppressed book on the Great Tax Exempt Foundations, and an interview with the author, Professor Carol Quigley. That's the Tragedy and Hope Special, my book, Brotherhood of Darkness. It's a, and, of course, you'll get the book Foundations of Their Power and Influence with the Tragedy and Hope Special. Again, our number, 1-800-544-8927. And then, of course, we want to remind all of our listeners about the Radio Liberty All-Day Conference on the 28th of October. That's a Sunday, and we're holding it on Sunday because we had so many people who couldn't get here on Saturday. It's going to be at the Aptos Seascape Golf Course and on the North Shore of Monterey Bay. Start at 8 o'clock in the morning, go till 5 in the evening. We'll be serving lunch, great speakers. But, of course, we need to know if you're coming. If you're coming from outside, we do have a group of rooms at the Seacliff Inn reserved. But you have to come in by the end, put your order in by the end of this month. You're not going to be able to get them at the special rate. And then, of course, we would like to hear, know if you're coming. Bring as many people as you can. I can assure you you'll have a good time. And we always do. We always enjoy the Radio Liberty conference there. And then, of course, since I'm really convinced, and I just hope and pray I'm wrong, but everything points to a coming war with Iran, that make preparations, because this could lead to a financial collapse. It could lead to unrest in this country. It could lead to counter-terrorist attacks that would actually tend to disrupt our society. If you've not yet made your preparations, if you'd like an emergency food catalog, if you'd like a health catalog or a regular catalog, our number 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And then we ask you to tell others about our programs, encourage them to listen. And if you'd like a free newsletter, give us a call. Our website, RadioLiberty.com. Thank you.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.